Yeah, sure. I don't know why it's not. I'm not gonna. No, actually, I'll put it on like 20 minutes. I'm gonna offer some reason. But you can definitely, yes.
Okay, what's the vote,
please? Yeah, that's it, there we are. Have you got it there, Robin?
Well, it's not changing, it's on 23.
23's pretty good, it'll get a warm up.
Yeah, but it's in 19 right now.
Yeah, it means it hasn't warmed up yet. No problem, okay. Don't close it completely, because then it'll we have this fault where it, I mean, you can close it, but it's not completely. Morning, everyone. I'm not sure if it's the rain or the topic, but we're missing some people today. It's all good to, you know, we experiment. So we're just going to have a two-week series, as we said last week, on the Kabbalah of animals. Today will be much more general, and then next week we're going to talk about specific animals and the lessons we can learn from them. So I saw recently a meditation technique that they were talking about meditating with your pet, that it can be a very beneficial practice for both you and your animal companion. I won't be doing that meditation, A, because I don't have a pet. Second of all, I'm not sure it works. But anyway, so I was wondering, like, there's something in this, like, what, you know, how do we understand the concept of animals? Now, it's interesting, if you look in the Talmud, you see some amazing things about animals, about things you can learn from animals, right? Certain character traits. There's a fascinating, famous piece in the Talmud that tells us that had the Torah not been given at Mount Sinai, if we wouldn't have received the Torah, we would still be able to learn some amazing things and good behavior traits from animals. For example, it says we would have learned modesty from a cat. Apparently a cat, when it relieves itself, it covers its waist. We would have learned the problem of stealing from an ant. Apparently ants, when they nibble on grain, they won't steal a piece of food from another ant. And would have learned morality and forbidden relationships from a dove. Doves apparently are very, very faithful to their partners. Interesting concept, right? So that's a greatness which you find in animals, which you would have learnt. In other words, the implication is that human beings wouldn't necessarily absorb these things. By default, human beings don't always, unless trained, unless thought, unless reflecting, they wouldn't have necessarily picked up these character traits. They need to learn them from somewhere. And if the Torah, God forbid, had not been given, they would learn these things from the animals. Now, there's another thing which also is interesting about animals, not just animals, but food in general. Someone commented before that they saw on the handout the question, why eat? Why do we need to eat?
Interest me.
Yeah, that's right. So I said I'd explain the question. In fact, it's interesting because it's got to do with this week's Torah portion, actually, where there's an interesting verse, and it says, "Ki lo alach lechem levado." A person doesn't only live on bread, but lives from the word of God. Now, what that simply means, literally means that it's not just food that sustains us, it's also the spiritual connection and the connecting with the creative force, the godly force that's in creation. But Kabbalistically, what that pasuk means is as follows. That apparently when we eat, Everything, as we know, has a godly spark, some sort of godly soul, a creative force that keeps it alive, not only humans, but everything. And when we eat, right, we are being sustained not only by the food, but by the godly spark that's in the food, right? Called the nitzus, it's a spark that is in the food. And the obvious question is, if that's the case, why can't we be, if it's the godly spark that sustains us, then why do we need to eat food and meat and so on? Why can't we just be sustained by the godly spark which is within ourselves, the soul which we have, right? If everything else has a soul, we for sure have a soul. So why do we need a different godly spark that's in, or godly energy that's in the food? And just to break this question down a little bit, Kabbalah tells us the following, that there are four layers of creation, right? There are what we call domem, which are silent creations like minerals, stones, mountains, dust, and so on. Then there's tsomer, things that grow, like vegetation, trees and so on, plants. Then there's chai, which is the animal kingdom, the living kingdom, in other words, the animal kingdom. And then there's medaber, which is the human being, right? And Kabbalah teaches the way it works is that each one is elevated within the next. So the earth becomes elevated by nourishing the plants, right? The plants are planted in the ground, and they derive their nourishment from the ground, and that becomes elevated within the thing, right? Within the plants. The plants, then the grass and so on, the hay, whatever is eaten by the animals, and it's elevated through the animals, and then meat, poultry or whatever animal, the animal kingdom, which is then eaten by the human being, and if eaten properly with the right focus, is elevated by the human being. So on the one hand, we see that the fact that we eat food means not just meat, but everything, and this is, of course, explained in Kabbalah, and we've talked about this before, that when we eat something, we eat it with the right focus, with the right blessing, and so on, we're actually elevating the food. But it's not only we elevating the food is elevating us. And part of the mechanism of how that works is because apparently the godly energy which we have within us is insufficient to sustain us. And there's a godly energy within the food that we eat which is higher or stronger or more powerful than the godly energy within ourselves, and that's what sustains us. And that's what the Pasuk means in this Torah portion, where we don't only live by the food, we actually live by the godly energy which is in the food. And the question is why? Why is it so powerful, and in what way is it more powerful than us that it sustains us? And does that make animals higher than human beings? How does it work, right? I mean, there's certainly, in the world today, there's certainly a thinking like that, that animals and human beings are the same thing and they're completely equal. I don't know if you remember, there was a long time ago, in the times of Arafat, when they sent a suicide bomber, but it wasn't a person, it was a horse, with a bomb into some Israeli settlement or something. And Peter, you know Peter, that thing in America that's for animal rights and all that, sent a letter to Arafat saying, please keep the animals out of the conflict. Right? Like, you know, you can send suicide bombers, but don't send animals. Like, keep the animals out of the conflict. A number of years ago, I don't know if you remember, also there was an interesting story about it, there was a whole tumult, a whole uproar. There was a zoo in America somewhere where a child somehow fell in or wandered into a cage of a very big gorilla. And the child was clearly in danger. And what happened was, the only way to save the child was they anesthetized the gorilla by shooting some injection into it, and ultimately the gorilla died. And it was a big, big, big hoo-ha about, like, was that the right thing to do? I mean, I'm not sure what the question was, but questions like that, you know, are asked, because there is a view, not the Jewish view, of course, but there is a view that, yeah, animals are beings like human beings. Now, they certainly, in the Jewish perspective, they certainly are living beings. And there's a great mitzvah in the Torah called Tsar Ba'alei Chaim, that we are not allowed to cause distress or pain to animals for no reason, right? That doesn't mean you can't call the pest control with cockroaches are running around your house. You could. Because if it's for the benefit of the human being, you can, but you have to be very sensitive. And you have to be sensitive to the animals and to their life. It's part of the sensitivity that we have, and it's part of how we behave, and we're not allowed to. In fact, there's even a law in the Torah that if a person has a domestic animal, whether it be a dog or an animal, whatever the case is, and they sit down to eat, and an animal needs to eat, We learn this from the Shema, actually, that you have to feed the animal before you feed yourself. It's an interesting thing, part of the sensitivity, right? But nevertheless, animals are not like human beings, and they're certainly not equal to human beings, and they're certainly not higher than human beings. Because going back to what we said before, there is a hierarchy in the Torah. There is a inanimate object, there's vegetation, there's a living kingdom, and there's the human being. The purpose of creation is certainly within the human. Everything else was created for the human to serve God and bring God into the world and to create a purpose and mission and meaning in this life. And therefore, animals do not take precedence, and they're certainly not equal, which is why we're allowed to eat food, and we're even allowed to eat meat, because actually it's there not indulgently and not in the wrong way, but we are allowed to eat it if it's for our benefit, and we elevate it, and so on and so forth. So animals certainly, in the hierarchy of creation, are not equal to human beings. And therefore, from a Jewish perspective, that question of the gorilla was a stupid question. Okay.
Rabbi, yeah.
No, you don't have to eat meat. I mean, it's an interesting discussion. Maybe we'll do a session on one day. So really, the truth is, it depends why. To be honest, the answer to that question is, if someone is vegetarian because they don't like meat, or someone is vegetarian for health reasons, which there are sometimes reasons for that, then it's fine. You don't have to eat meat, particularly nowadays. You might have a bit of a problem when Mashiach comes, because we'll be eating sacrificial meat, like the Korban Pesach and all that, so... which I'm looking forward to. I mean, a good barbecue is a good thing. But for the people who don't like meat, it would be a problem. Yeah, well. Not sure. I think it'll be a lamb. However, if someone is a vegetarian philosophically, because they don't want to eat meat and they want to hurt the animal, that's a problem. Philosophically, it's a problem. From a Torah perspective, because it's actually not the same. Obviously, the meat should be kosher. I mean, if it's not going to be kosher, better to be vegetarian. But okay. So I want to share with you just two, they sustain us, but they're not higher than us, they're lower than us. What's going on, right? So I want to just share with you two short ideas, but then also take it a lot deeper to a sort of a Kabbalistic level and see what we can learn from that as well, right? So I saw an interesting article, it's in H.com, where someone was Ask Rabbi sort of channel in the website. And the guy writes the question that he has a dog and he loves it dearly, which is fine, a lot of people do. And it's brought joy to their life and smiles to many people's faces. And he said, I've heard that animals don't have souls, how can that be? I think when I take my dog on a walk, it's got a higher soul than some humans. There's no question in my mind that my dog knows wrong from right and will do everything in the power to cheer up someone who needs it, and so on and so forth. It goes on a whole rant that what's the Jewish view on this? And the rabbi explains very nicely. He says the following. Firstly, he says, as we said before, that every human being, every human thing actually, every creation has a soul. Different types of soul, but every creation has a soul. Animals have souls for sure, so does vegetation. And in fact, even inanimate objects have a spark, have a soul, because the Baal Shem Tov explained that when God created the world, and God created the world with 10 utterances, right? So the Baal Shem Tov was very strong, and it's explained in the book of Tanya as well, very, very great detail, that you cannot say that God just created the world and left it alone, but God's creative force in the world is constant. So we call in Hebrew his havut midi, which means that it's constant creation. There's always the spark of God coming from the 10 utterances that are in every single created thing, even a stone, that continuously keeps it alive. And were that spark, were that soul, if you want to call it that, were to depart from that creation, even for one moment, the creation would disintegrate and become nothing, just as it was before the world was created. So everything has a nefesh, everything has a soul. I don't know if you remember, I once told you an interesting thing, just in parentheses, when they were translating the book of Tanya, the person translating it would send the copies of the translation into the Lubavitch Rebbe, and he would check and he would make comments and so on. And in Tanya, it talks about these four layers of creation, and they often refer to the lowest level, in other words, the stones, the minerals, the mountains, as inanimate objects, right? Inanimate almost means like it's dead, it's not alive, it has no life, right? And the Rebbe didn't want that translation, even though that's the common translation. And the Rebbe suggested that rather than call it inanimate, they should call it silent. Because in Hebrew, it's actually domem. The word domem means to be silent. Meaning, of course, it's alive like everything else, but it's a lower level of life, and its life is such that you don't notice movement. So you don't notice there's a life, you don't notice a soul, because the soul is silence. Even a stone has a spark, but it's silent, right? So there's a bit of back and forth, because the fear was that people are not going to understand what that means. So what does it mean a stone is silent, right? So I think eventually what happened was they decided to use the word silent, but in brackets they put inanimate or something like that, right? But everything has a soul. As it comes up the ladder, the soul is more noticeable and the soul is more intense. So you have silent beings, and you have vegetation, which you can see movement, you can see life because it grows. Then, of course, you have animals, where you can see real life. And not only can you see life, but what you begin to notice in animals is the concept of emotion. So, of course, there's love, there's loyalty, there's anger, there's aggression, there's good emotions, bad emotions. And certainly, animals, you definitely notice there's a layer. You don't notice it so much in plants, but you do notice it in animals where there's already interaction of some sort, not like a human being, but the interaction, there's emotion, there's feelings and so on. However, this is where the human soul is different. An animal soul, including our own animal soul, which is within us, but that's, we'll get that later, but a soul that's in an animal has emotions, and for example, we'll see later, a dog, for example, just as we'll bring it in here, a dog in Hebrew is called kelev, right? You know why? Anyone else why? The sources say because it's kololev, it's full of heart, right? It doesn't mean it can't get angry sometimes and bark. And I mean, a lot of dogs apparently hate rabbis, because every time I walk in the door, they start barking. So it's full of heart, which is why they're loyal, that's why they love, and they bring love, it's true. However, the emotions that are in an animal are instincts, impulses. They're there, and it's full of feeling, but there's no force that can navigate those emotions. That's only within a human being, right? A human being has a deeper neshama where the insight comes into it, the intellect comes into it. Now, an animal also has intellect, but intellect and animal is very different, because the seichel, the sort of wisdom, like sometimes animals, you can see they will navigate situations, obviously using some sort of brain activity, right? But it's a different type of brain activity. The brain activity there is to fully serve the emotion. So that's about how do I achieve my impulse, but I don't really have control of our impulse, right? In other words, the human intellect has the power to make a decision, the power of morality, the power of right and wrong, the power to decision make, to achieve purpose and meaning is only within a human being, right? And therefore we can control our pleasures, we control our impulses, we can make decisions to hold back, to make decisions and so on. I'm just quoting from the article. He says, you'll never see a hungry dog say to his friend, let's not fight over this. It's not a nice thing to fight. Or let's save some for Fido, who will come later. He's late today, so we'll save a bit of food for him, right? You don't see that. Unless it's an instinct. Certain animals have certain instincts about taking care of their young and all that kind of stuff. Now, we will talk later about the importance of the energy that we can absorb and harness from the animals. But what's interesting is, even the meat that the Torah permits us to eat, here's an interesting thing, right? We know that one of the prohibitions in kashrut of eating even kosher animals is the prohibition of eating blood. Right? Why? Because there's a verse that tells us, this is one of the reasons, a verse that tells us that ki hadam hu hanefesh, the soul, the passion of the soul, rests in the blood. Right? And while we can eat animals, and in fact, sometimes it's even considered a positive thing if we can harness the good from the animals, but we can't eat the blood of the animals. That's why an animal has to be kashrut, through salt, it's got to extract the blood and so on, right? Because we shouldn't absorb the animalistic, instinctive, impulsive force within the animals. And that's why we're supposed to get rid of the blood first and just take the good, just take the meat, which we'll talk about later what that means. Now again, so he says that, as he rightly points out in this article, this is not in any way to demean or undermine the value of animals, and people who, I mean, I've spoke to many, many people, although I'm not planning to get one myself, but I've spoke to many, many people who have dogs and have amazing, brings them amazing comfort and joy, and there is love and there is loyalty and all that is true. But nevertheless, it's on a different level. It's not a being that can make a decision, that can make, decide on a moral response. That is something that rests entirely with the human being. And that's why the purpose of creation is the human being. And that's why we see in the 6 days of creation, as the Midrash tells us, that the human being was created last, because everything was there prepared for the human being, and it's a human being's task to bring morality, to bring divine, to bring godliness into the world by navigating wrong and right, morality, spirituality, godliness, and so on. Okay. That's just one point. The other point is, before we go into the depth of an animal and what it actually means and why we have to eat animals or eat food to be sustained, is something that Zvi Freeman writes. There's a book, an ancient book called Perek Shira. Perek Shira is some ancient midrashic work that talks about the songs that animals sing to God. Right? We sing praises to God. We pray. Every animal, with their barking, with their mooing, with their whatever you call the different ways that animals express themselves, the birds chirping, whatever the case is, embedded in those sounds are actually praises and songs to God. And it's a book that goes through it, each one, what song they're singing, what it means, and interprets it, and so on. Now, there it says that the last one is the story of the frog, apparently. I don't know, I'm not well versed in this picture, but it's the story of the frog. And at the end, the frog boasts to King David that the song is more beautiful than anything that King David could compose, right? In other words, there's something very deep in animals, as we'll soon see, we'll soon explore. But nevertheless, it's animals. Animals with all the egocentricity, with all the emotional impulsivity that they have, which they cannot overcome, right? Now, what's interesting is, what's the definition of a human being? When we see in the 6 days of creation, right, where God designs the human being, right? Human being is a combination of the lowest form of creation and the highest form of existence. In other words, an animal is flesh and it's got a soul, an animal soul. We also have an animal soul, as we've talked about many, many times. We have a godly soul and animal soul. Our animal soul is animalistic, like the animals, right? But we also have a soul. Now, what's the message of that soul? The soul of the human is how it's written and described in the very beginning of Genesis, where it says that when God made clay and he formed the dust in order to create a human being, God blew into the nostrils of the human being a soul of life. And we know the Kabbalah explains the imagery of the blowing as a part, as distinct from the rest of creation, which is speech. God spoke and he said, let there be light and let there be heaven and so on. That just like in the human speaking something external, whereas blowing is something that comes from inside, comes from within us, right? God, so to speak, gave a part of his essence, he gave a part of himself into the human being. So on the one hand, we are dust, with all the lowliness of dust and the animalistic traits which were put into us with our animal soul. On the other hand, we have the soul, which is hugely high. In other words, it's transcendent. It's a piece of God, so to speak. It's a godly energy and a godly infusion that's within us. And this is the essence of the human being, because the human being's creation is really indicative of what our purpose is here, right? Unlike every other creation, the human being is a combination from that which is extremely high and that which is extremely low. Why is that the design of the human being? Because that's the purpose of the human being. The purpose of the human being is to marry heaven and earth, is to bring the transcendent, the godliness, the divine into the worldliness, into the materialism of the world, right? And we've talked about this many times. This is the emphasis of Judaism. Judaism is not a religion where you have to disconnect from the world in order to serve. On the contrary, we're not supposed to disconnect. We're not supposed to disengage. Of course, we have spiritual experiences. We pray, we learn, and so on. But our purpose is actually mostly to engage with the physical and to bring the transcendent into the physical, which is why most of our mitzvot, as we always say, are physical actions, right? Because we elevate the candle, we elevate the leather and make a mezuzah. We elevate the food, we make a bracha, we eat kosher. We elevate the time by Rosh Chodesh, all these different things, right? And that's what a human being is. The human being is certainly unique, and it's not just that we're a kind of higher form of animal, we're a completely different and distinct creation, the only creation that can actually has this ability to combine heaven and earth, to bring intellect into the heart. This is the concept of the brain ruling the heart, but even more than that, to bring that which is so high into elevating and refining into that which is so low. Okay. Having said all that, so why do we need the energy of the animal? So let me share with you a deep Kabbalistic idea. First of all, we have a concept in Kabbalah called Seder Hishtalshlut. Seder Hishtalshlut means it's the Kabbalistic version of evolution. What I mean to say, not the evolution in the Darwinian sense, but the Kabbalistic evolution, right? So we learn that God is infinite. God is transcendent. This is pure Kabbalah, I'm teaching you. I hope it's okay, yeah? God is undefined, right? But he desired, for whatever reason, he desired to create a world, a physical world, a lowly world, a world where he is completely hidden and not obvious, for the purpose because he desired for us to make him obvious, right? So that's the purpose of creation, essentially, according to Hasidic philosophy, Kabbalistic philosophy, that the world was created so that the world was created in an empty place. It's called, in Hasidic terminology, it's called Dira B'Tachtonim, which means the purpose is to make a dwelling place for God in this world, to invite him into this world by making the world a better place, by bringing the divine through the mitzvah, through serving him, and so on and so forth, right? So what he does is he creates a world where he's completely not obvious, although he's here, but if you look at the world, you don't see God. The godly consciousness is something you don't achieve, obviously, and automatically in this world. And the idea is, so therefore it's a world of darkness, getting darker, by the way. That's what happens just before the light comes, just before the sunrise, just before dawn, it gets very dark. That's okay. So, and in the darkness, we're supposed to discover the light, we're supposed to bring light and discover the light, and discover God, where it's not obvious. Now, when we say God himself is undefined and transcendent, it doesn't mean that God is spiritual. That's a big mistake people make. He's spiritual too. But spirituality is another definition. Right? A being that is spiritual only means that it transcends the frames of reference of the physical world. So something that is spiritual doesn't have space, doesn't have touch, doesn't have dimensions, right? It's not caught within the concept of time. Yeah? Tell me if I'm losing you. If I don't make sense, tell me. All right? I'll give you an example, an analogy. You can sort of understand that. That the most abstract and non-tangible thing we can think of in this world is, let's say, an idea. An idea. Right? An idea is also a creation. We just don't look at it like that because it doesn't have the same frame of reference as a table or a chair. Right? But an idea is also a creation. Now, it's just a creation it's not subject to the limitations of the physicality. So for example, I can be thinking of an idea and you can be thinking of an idea at the same time. So the idea can live in my head and your head exactly the same time. Correct? Table can't be here and there at the same time. This table, at least, anyways, right? It can be here. Many tables, but they're different tables. Right? Whereas an idea, there can be an idea, 2 + 2 = 4, whatever the case is, an idea, a concept, and I can be thinking, you can be thinking exactly the same time, so it could live in two people's heads at the same time. Because it's not subject to the limitations of space and time, right? That doesn't mean it's not a defined idea. An idea is an idea, it's not something else. An idea is a concept, an intellectual concept, it's not an emotion. Right? It has its own definitions, has its own frame of reference. And that's why we say that when we talk about God in Kabbalah, we talk about God being essentially undefined. It's not that his wisdom is greater than our wisdom, or our wisdom is infinite, his wisdom is fine. Our wisdom is finite, his wisdom is infinite. Or we more physical, and he's more spiritual. No. He transcends the physical and the spiritual. We don't know what God is because he's nothing and he's everything. Everything comes from him, but he cannot be defined by anything. Yeah, we good so far? So how did God wanted a very, very He wanted a creation. He wanted something, so to speak, outside of his reality, or at least seems to be outside of his reality. And in that itself, he wanted something that is very low and very physical and very concealing of his existence. So the first step was, because God is omnipotent, he can do whatever he wants. He can, he's not defined, and he's completely transcends us, but he could express himself in a defined way if he wants to, right? So he brought, so Kabbalah teaches us that he brought out within himself, he brought out within himself 10 ways to express himself, which is known as the 10 sfirot, the 10 powers, the 10 godly powers, which is Chochmah, Bina, Da'at, those are the three intellectual ones. And there's Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet, and so on. Right? We've talked about that many times. And when God did that and he expresses himself in this, in these 10 defined ways, those are known as the 10 Sefirot. And at the first stage, that's God's powers. It's God, God chose 10 manifestations of himself. And that's known in Kabbalah as the world of Atzilut. Right? Then what he did was, he had a system of evolution. These 10 powers, the 10 godly powers that God chose to express himself in, gave birth to a created world, but a very spiritual world, also governed by 10 powers known as the Bria, and that gave forth to another world, and another world, and those worlds have angels, and all kinds of things, which are also connected to these 10 powers, and eventually by a spiritual godly evolution system, it came down after one layer, after another layer, diluted more and more and more, until it lands up with this physical world, which is the lowest form of the lowest form of existence, right? And everything that exists in this world, obviously is created by God, but created by God through this godly evolution system, so to speak, which is called the Seder Ishtalshlut. And therefore everything that is created here has a divine origin in the upper worlds, in the loft, in the spiritual worlds, in the godly worlds. Right? Yeah, yeah, we're good?
Like a dilution.
Like a dilution. It's called Tzimtzum in Kabbalah, yeah. Which is why we have a part of Tanakh, a very famous vision, by Yechezkel, Ezekiel. Ezekiel has this vision one day, and this is the way it's described. It says, the heavens opened up. He writes, heavens opened one day, it was a certain day. The heavens opened up, and I was able to see the celestial vision, known as the celestial chariot. And he describes this vision. It's very, very cryptic, very Kabbalistic, very, very esoteric. And he describes this vision in physical terminology, of fire and beings and angels. In fact, just a fun fact, the word in modern Hebrew for electric is chashmal, right? You know that? Chashmal is electric in Israel. That actually comes from Tanakh. It's actually taken from the vision of Yechezkel. The word chashmal is found in Tanakh, but it means something totally different. It means it's talking about some revelation, fiery revelation, that Ezekiel saw in this vision, which is he refers to as chashmal. And they took it, in modern Hebrew, they took it for electric, for light. Yeah. Anyway, so he sees there, and he talks about a chariot, and the chariot has angels, and the angels are carrying it, and it's four pillars of the chariot, etc., etc. And he talks about four images there. One image is the image of the human. One image is the image of the lion, the image of the eagle, and the image of the ox. The ox. A bull or an ox, whatever. And it all refers, according to the Kabbalists, all refers to all sorts of angels and Kabbalistic beings and all kinds of things, which are all the origin. They're all very fiery beings, except for the human. The fiery beings, they all express different emotions. And they're actually referenced to the angels, which, by the way, the angels are also called animals. I think we mentioned this before. In our prayers, when we refer to angels, or we do refer to angels, we call them the Chayot HaKodesh, the holy animals. Right? Now, the animals that are angels, why are they animals? Because they're instinctive, they're emotional, they're full of emotion, they have insight too, but it's instinctive inside, it's more like an animal. They are emotional beings, fiery beings. One is more fiery in Chesed, the other one is more fiery in Gevurah, but they're fiery animalistic beings. It's just their animalistic energy, of course, is holy. It's pure, it's godly.
Is it also because they're single-purpose?
They're only single-purpose, because that's what they are, because you can only merge opposites when you have the insight, the seichel that we have, right? But they are like animals. And animals down here, including our own animal soul, evolve from those beings. Now, why am I telling you all of this? Let me go to another. Sorry, we don't normally do this, but it's okay, right? Just to, we need to understand this to get to the point. So Kabbalah is another concept, and it goes like this. When God created the world, part of the evolutionary process to get to his 10 manifestations that he expresses himself in, there's two worlds that is described in Kabbalah. The world of chaos and the world of order. Known in Kabbalah as Tohu and Tikkun. When God created the world, when God set in motion this Kabbalistic evolutionary system, he first created a very, very bright light. Where every one of these ten emotions, or seven emotions, I should say, from Chesed onwards, was existing in the most explosive and intense way. Right? Not contained, just full energy. But what that became, because it had no containment and wasn't orderly, it became known in Kabbalah as the world of chaos. And it exploded, whatever exploding means in the Kabbalistic terms. And the energy from that world of chaos was instilled into the emotional beings known as the animals. First, the animals, the supernal animals, like the malachim and the angels. And by evolution, into the animals that we have in this world. Right? Then God took this power and created the next stage of the evolution, which is the world of order, where there's containment, where one energy can coexist with the other energy, right? And the way it's explained in Kabbalah is that the world of chaos is a world of pure emotional energy. Like, you know where you can see it? You can see it in a child, right? You can see that explosion, that chaos in a child. You know, you see little children that when they're your friend, when they're loving, they like, it's only good. The whole world is fantastic, right? There's nothing wrong, except when his older brother hits him and pushes him aside, and then the whole world is evil, right? He hates this one, and he's living, and he's crying, and the world came to an end. It never comes together. There's no compartmentalization, there's no merging, there's no, right? Because it's the world of chaos. A child is also like, a child doesn't have intellect. You need intellect to create a world of order, right? A child is a bit animalistic that way, by design, but because a child is, the animal soul is working stronger than the godly soul, right? Therefore, it's also connected to the world of chaos, and it's an unbelievable energy. The love is beautiful, the anger is disastrous, but that's the way a child operates, right? Until there's maturity. So a child is a good example of migrating from the world of chaos to the world of order, right? Because the maturity comes, the intellect comes, you hope at least, doesn't always happen, but yeah. And then they start to make decisions, you know, I'm a bit angry, I should calm it down, I'm overwhelming people with my love, I should stay back, whatever the case is. You start to merge chesed and gevurah, as we've talked about many, many times, right? Now, the soul that the human has is from the world of order. But here's the thing. Kabbalah teaches us that the world of chaos preceded the world of order. And the world of chaos actually is a higher world. It's a more powerful world. The way it evolved and fell all the way down into animals, which are lower than the human being. But actually the source, the origin of the animal energy is actually higher than the human being. Right? It comes from a more powerful source. That world of chaos, it's chaotic down here, but actually it comes from a world of intensity, it comes from a world of brilliance, of powerful energy, light, powerful light. It hasn't been contained, but it's a very powerful light. Right? And here's how it works. The purpose of creation is not the world of chaos. World of creation is the world of order, right? Because God wanted us to make moral decisions. He wanted us to create an order in the world. He wanted us to refine the universe. He wanted us to prioritize values, to know the difference between wrong and right, to merge things, to integrate emotions, to use tolerance one day, but intolerance for evil the next day, to use this emotion today, the other emotion tomorrow, with maturity, with order, with purpose and with meaning. Purpose and meaning can never happen in the world of chaos, because the world of chaos is all over the place. It needs maturity, it needs order, it needs thinking, it needs a plan, it needs a strategy. So therefore, the ultimate will of God is not the world of chaos, the world, it's the world of order. But, and that's why the neshama, the godly soul we have, comes from the world of order, comes that maturity, that seichel, that intellect, we're able to make those decisions and to create purpose and create order. But, here's the point. In order to make order, and that's why the human being is the purpose of creation, you know, we talk about this in a number of weeks, right? It's now, today's the 20th of Av, which is 40 days before Rosh Hashanah. Right? I'm not trying to scare anyone, I'm saying it's 40 days, it's 40 days, right? No, there's a concept that's brought down the source about the significance of 40 days before Rosh Hashanah. So, on Rosh Hashanah, we know we celebrate the creation of the world, but we don't celebrate the first day of creation. We've talked about this many times. We celebrate the sixth day of creation, the day that the human being was created. Not the day the animals were created, not the day the birds were created, the day that the human being was created. Why? Because the purpose of creation is to create order. The purpose of creation is the human being. However, in order to do that, in order to build a real relationship with God, in order to create the coming together of the body and soul, in order to create that idea of bringing heaven down to earth, right? Bringing godliness into a world that is the antithesis of godliness, right? In order to do that with careful planning and strategy, we are the world of order, but we need the energy from the world of chaos. Otherwise, it dissipates. The analogy for that is when a child migrates from being a child to an adult, sometimes people become very, very mature and they're able to make decisions and able to make moral choices, but they lose the positives of the childlike energy. Because there's something special about the childlike energy. There's something very special about the world of chaos, which we see in animals or we see in young children. Their passion, the excitement, the strong emotion. Now, it needs to be guided. The world of order has to be in charge, because otherwise it's just a mess. But it cannot be abandoned. That's the point. The world of chaos cannot be abandoned. The world of chaos must be harnessed. So, because in order to really have a relationship with God and to be a proper human being, in fact, not a relationship with God, not to have any relationship with anything, or any person for sure. Relationships are built on love, emotion, passion, excitement, empathy, care, noticing, all these things. These are all emotions. And the stronger the emotions are, when kept in order, the better the relationship is. So the problem of the energy, of the animalistic energy, the emotional energy, is not that it's emotional, it's that it's all over the place. But what the problem is that when you start to administer the world of order, you make an order, but you often lose the intensity of the emotion. And that's a problem. And therefore, as we navigate the human experience, especially in a godly way, which is really fulfilling the purpose and meaning of creation, which is from the world of order, we actually have to harness a bit of the energy from the world of chaos. Which actually, in the evolutionary system of God, comes from a higher, more powerful place than the world of order. Which then puts together everything. There is a part of animals which is higher than us. In fact, not only animals, but anything physical. The world of chaos came into the world. It's a very chaotic world unless we make an order, right? It's a crazy world. And therefore, we need to eat. Even though we have our own energy, even though we have our own soul, yet there's a source and origin of the energy which is in the food that we eat, vegetation, even animals, that is higher than us, comes from a higher source of us. It comes from the source of the world of chaos. But we have to harness it. We have to leave the blood out of it and just harness the good. And therefore, there's so much to learn from animals. They're not as high as the human being. The purpose of the creation is the human being, and therefore animals are there to serve the human being. But they serve in a very powerful way, that we don't only sustain ourselves by our own soul, because that's not good enough. We need the chaotic energy that the animals have, which we will then navigate and put into order, but we need that power. We need the love of a dog, even. We need the gevura of a cow. We need the humility of a sheep. All these different very strong impulses and very strong, we even need aggression sometimes when it comes to evil, right? We can isolate certain strengths and certain things within animals that we need to harness. Not only talk about it and learn from it, but actually integrate it within our own being. We have to integrate the world of chaos within our own world. And that's why we need to, Kabbalistic, that's why we need to eat. That's why physiologically we need to eat, because everything physical stems from a spiritual thing. So it's not because our body works that we need to eat. No, it's actually we need to harness the energy that's in the animals, so God designed us that the body needs food. Right, it's the other way around. We have a certain element of chaos, because our animal soul also has chaos.
So it comes from the animal.
But it's the animal part of us,
part of which
we then have to sustain by eating animal stuff.
Chaos,
oh, yeah, we have plenty of chaos.
Cat,
No. We have plenty of chaos. But we have, because we have an animal part within us as well, don't forget, right?
So are you going to say that vegetarian is lacking some degree of chaos?
Maybe. Maybe that's why vegetarians are very calm, I don't know. Look, it's the concept. I don't know, I'm not saying you always have to physically eat meat. I mean, even halachically, great tzaddikim, great people didn't always eat meat. I mean, it's not that we have to eat meat every day. On the contrary, actually. So the short answer to you is, like, actually meat has greater chaos, Kabbalistically. And that's why, actually, there were many great people who avoided eating meat. Because actually it's dangerous, but very powerful if you can harness it properly. That's why there were great people who only ate meat on Shabbat, for example. Because they felt that was the day they could harness it properly. They eat it for the right reason, because Shabbat, and right? That's another concept altogether about mixing chesed and gevura. You know, I'm not supposed to. Yeah, it's wrong. It's wrong chaos in a way. Yeah, similar. Yeah. Now, just one final point, right? And that's why. And next week, what you do, you're going to take some examples of harnessing the chaos of the animals in a good way, right? Even non-kosher animals, there's a concept of we don't eat them, but we still integrate the ideas into our own experience. But what's a very interesting thing, I'll just finish with this because it's a very interesting concept. This also explains why somewhere in our daily prayers, every day, weekday, Shabbat, Yom Kippur, Hashanah, every time we pray in the morning prayers, there's a whole section when we talk about animals. Not animals, like angels. The supernal animals, right? Why do we do that? Because it teaches us a lesson, right? When we pray, we're supposed to connect to God. And often we think to ourselves, you know, the world of chaos is too hard. It's too hard to navigate. It's too hard to refine. It's too hard to channel. So what we do is we talk about the angels to remind ourselves Kabbalistically, this is the Kabbalistic explanation, that the animals that we have, both in ourselves and the animals around us, actually have a very holy source. Actually, they're not just crazy people, not just crazy beings. They actually have a very holy and sublime source, which is the world of chaos, but a godly world of chaos. In fact, they evolved from the angels. The cow evolves from the supernal ox. The birds evolved from the supernal eagle. Non-kosher animals evolved from the supernal lion, the one that Ezekiel saw. It didn't look like a lion, obviously, but that was the imagery, right? And therefore, they come from a godly source, and therefore they have a godly purpose. And therefore they have a purpose, and therefore the purpose is for us to engage with it, right? To engage with it and to try and channel it and to work with it. So that was a bit esoteric, but what we're going to do next week is we're going to take a few animals and have a look at them and see what they teach us and how we channel the energy that they have. Have a wonderful week. Sorry? About the God. No, the lower there's different levels of angels.
Right.
So the lower one looks towards upwards because they want to serve God in the same way. Yeah, that's the noisy animals versus the quiet animals. It's different concepts.
Yeah, we can